FBI agent Roger LaJeunesse, whom Turner had known years before in the Bureau, confided that Pena had left the LAPD for a, quote, special training unit at a CIA base in Virginia. In fact, said LaJeunesse, Pena's departure in November 67 had not been a one-shot deal. The detective had done CIA special assignments for a decade, mostly under AID cover. On some of these assignments in Central and South America, he worked with CIA operative Dan A. Mitrione, a former Indiana chief of police. Further confirmation of Pena's CIA role came from his brother, a high school teacher, who casually mentioned to television newsman Stan Borman how proud Manny was of his services for the CIA over the years. Reporter Fernando Faura, whose byline appeared on the newspaper story of the farewell banquet, recounted that in April 1968, only 5 months after Pena's departure, he was sauntering along a corridor in Parker Center when he spotted a vaguely familiar figure. The square face and fireplug frame seemed to belong to Manny Pena, but now he sported an expensive dark blue suit, a black handlebar mustache, and heavy horn-rimmed glasses. Manny? Faura probed. The figure stopped and looked sheepish as the reporter approached, with hand extended. Hey, Manny, I damn near didn't recognize you with that disguise. The detective was not amused. Faura asked what he was doing back in Los Angeles. Pena explained that the AID job wasn't quite what he had expected, so he quit and resumed his duties with the LAPD. Pena's stints with the CIA were hardly unique. For example, Hugh C. McDonald, who was chief of detectives for the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department before retiring in 67, recently revealed in a book that for many years he had gone on detached duty with the CIA as a contract agent, primarily in operations in conjunction with white Russian emigre elements in Europe. And, according to Morton Kondrake of the Chicago Sun-Times, quote, a high-ranking former official of the spy agency said in an interview that he remembered some Chicago policemen attending training sessions at the CIA's super-secret facility at Camp Perry near Williamsburg, Virginia, either in late 1967 or early 1968. The agency itself conceded that, quote, briefings were given to, quote, less than 50 policemen from, quote, about a dozen departments. And we learn much later that Pena's SUS sidekick, Sergeant Hank Hernandez, who was promoted to lieutenant in recognition of his status in the special unit, also had CIA connections. Now retired from the force, he boasts in a resume offering his services as a private investigator. Then in 1963, he played a key role in Unified Police Command training for the CIA in Latin America. He functioned under the usual cover of AID's Office of Public Safety and even received a medal from the Venezuelan government, then concerned with Fidel Castro's, quote, exportation of the Cuban Revolution. In retrospect, it seems odd that two policemen who doubled as CIA agents occupied key positions in Special Unit Senator, where they were able to seal off avenues that led in the direction of conspiracy.
Okay, so there you have it. At least one example of some nation builders who were at work in other parts of the world participating in a key respect in the cover-up of the assassination of a major American political figure. And again, keep in mind the hypothesis that what we're looking at with all of our assassinations may be analogous to what went on in Nazi Germany. And keep in mind the whole nation-building thesis that Fletcher Prouty presents in his book The Secret Team. Now, one of the things that has piqued the curiosity of a lot of investigators have been the numerous what researchers refer to as evidentiary tributaries that run among the various assassinations. Now, not only are the assassinations and the attempted assassinations portrayed as the work of lone nuts, but they are the official version maintains that there is no connection whatsoever. You know, just a bunch of screwballs going around pulling triggers with no rhyme nor reason to the whole thing. Well, upon examination of each of the individual cases, it becomes clear very quickly that there are a lot of connecting links and similar elements and certain threads running through all of the assassinations. And we're going to cover a few of those for you. Some of the connecting links between the assassination of Robert Kennedy, the shooting of George Wallace, and the assassination of Martin Luther King. Okay. Now, one of the, I'm going to go back and read a little bit more from the books that Nip was just reading reading to you from. It's called The Assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, published in hardcover by Random House, copyrighted 1978, co-authored by William W. Turner, former FBI agent, and John G. Christian. Christian is just as in Christian. Christian, by the way, was a former TV newsman, I believe, with KGO here in the Bay Area. I'm not sure exactly which station. I believe it was KGO. Now, jumping back again, recall that in Jim Garrison's investigation of the Kennedy assassination, although he indicted Clay Shaw and although the jury found that there had definitely been a conspiracy to assassinate President Kennedy, they were unable to conclude beyond a reasonable doubt that Clay Shaw was guilty. And you recall that one of the reasons we mentioned that Jim Garrison was unable to achieve a conviction of Clay Shaw was the fact that three key figures whom he attempted to have extradited in connection with his investigation were not actually, there were more than three, but three of the main ones were not extradited. First of all, there was an anti-Castro Cuban named Sergio Arcacha Smith, who had fled to, who was in Texas at the time. Garrison attempted to have him extradited from Texas. Then Texas Governor John Connally, who was in the motorcade, wounded along with Kennedy, helped plan the motorcade, and who was Secretary of the Navy, downgraded Lee Harvey Oswald's discharge to dishonorable ex post facto. He refused, John Connally, that is, refused to extradite Sergio Arcacha Smith to New Orleans. Now, a second fellow who we talked about in connection with as a possible eraser of the Watergate tapes last week was a fellow by the name of Gordon Novell, last name N-O-V-E-L. He fled to Ohio, and then Governor of Ohio John Rhodes agreed to extradite Novell to New Orleans under the condition that Garrison would agree not to question him about the JFK assassination. Well, of course, that was why, to question him about the JFK assassination was why Garrison attempted to have Novell extradited, okay? Now, the third of these individuals that Garrison wanted to have extradited was a man named Edgar Eugene Bradley, last name B-R-A-D-L-E-Y. Now, Bradley was affiliated with the ACCC, the American Council of Christian Churches, headed by right-wing evangelist Carl McIntyre. Recall, that's identified in Nomenclature of an Assassination Cabal as a U.S. intelligence front, and also identified as early as 1942 of sponsoring Nazi activities in the United States. Now, Edgar Eugene Bradley was stopped by Dallas policeman Roger Craig stopped a person who he said looked like Oswald coming out of the back of the Texas school book depository. Up came a man identifying himself as a Secret Service agent who later turned out not to be a Secret Service agent, and he obtained the release of this particular man. Now, Roger Craig later from photographs identified the bogus Secret Service agent as Edgar Eugene Bradley. Now, Jim Garrison attempted to have Bradley extradited. Then Deputy State Attorney General Charles A. O'Brien, who you heard Nip refer to in the section of the Robert Kennedy book that he read, he reviewed Garrison's extradition request, recommended that it be granted. Now, the day-to-day handling of the Edgar Eugene Bradley request was maintained by Edwin Meese, then legal counselor to Governor Reagan, now, of course, presidential special White House advisor. And He handled the supervision of the day-to-day goings-on vis-a-vis Edgar Eugene Bradley. Then Governor of California Ronald Reagan delayed any action upon the Bradley extradition request until after Richard Nixon was elected president, and then turned it down without comment. And that is one of the main reasons why Garrison was unable to achieve a conviction, okay? Now, keep in mind Jerry Owen, the person who appears to have been driving around Saran and may have been driving a getaway car at the assassination of Robert Kennedy. Now, the Davis you're going to hear referred to here is George T. Davis, a San Francisco attorney. Interestingly enough, Bradley, this fellow, again, we're supposedly we're dealing with lone nuts here with no connection. Bradley is connected with Jerry Owen here. Reading from The Assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. After Davis left the room to make some phone calls, Owen raised the question of John Kennedy's assassination. Obviously, Davis had briefed him on Turner's participation in the Jim Garrison investigation. As Turner spread a number of photographs from his attaché case on the table, Owen looked them over. His finger came to rest on one of Edgar Eugene Bradley of North Hollywood, who 6 months before had been indicted by a New Orleans grand jury for conspiracy in the JFK assassination. The charges were later dismissed. Bradley was the West Coast representative of Dr. Carl McIntyre, the fundamentalist minister who founded the American Council of Christian Churches in opposition to the modernist, quote-unquote, National Council of Christian Churches. "Do you know Bradley?" Turner asked. "Yes," said Owen. He explained that he had casually met him a couple of times in Los Angeles, the last in 1964. "I was affiliated with McIntyre's church in the late 50s, Owen said, "but got out because these people were too radical for me." So again, this supposedly random group of individuals appears to be perhaps not so random. Now, keep in mind the name of Edgar Eugene Bradley here. Now, recall that Lee Harvey Oswald, in an interview with two CIA-connected individuals called Carlos Bringier of the DRE that we talked about last time, and a guy named Jim Butler of the Information Council for the Americas, who Nip's going to tell you about in a second, basically a very convincing, certainly thoroughgoing attempt was made to maintain Oswald, that Oswald was a communist, okay? A similar attempt at sort of painting Ceylon red followed the assassination of Robert Kennedy. And the key organization, one of the organizations to keep in mind with a press conference attempting to paint Ceylon red is an organization called American United. Now, American United was put together by two reactionaries called John Steinbacher, last name S-T-E-I-N-B-A-C-H-E-R, and a guy named Anthony J. Hilder, H-I-L-D-E-R. And their press conference following the assassination of Robert Kennedy, an attempt to sort of portray Ceylon red, are touched on briefly by Turner and Christian as follows. American United was the two-man show of John Steinbacher, a John Birch Society propagandist and part-time reporter for the Anaheim Bulletin in Orange County, and Anthony J. Hilder, a firebrand activist. Both were protégés of the well-known anti-Semite Myron J. Fagan, a leader of the Hollywood blacklisting clique during the McCarthy era. In fact, Hilder and a gaggle of followers had been at the Ambassador Hotel the previous night trying to race-bait RFK by handing out buttons and pamphlets depicting him and black Congressman Adam Clayton Powell Jr. of New York on the same ticket. After the shooting, the Hilder group created considerable confusion by alleging that the assailant was a Eugene McCarthy supporter. Steinbacher and Hilder had prepared a press kit crammed with their prolific output of ultra-right polemics. And basically, they went on to talk about how basically Ceylon was a left-wing a pawn of something called the Illuminati, but anyway, a communist, and that he had supposedly killed Kennedy as part of a communist conspiracy. Again, the same sort of painting of the Patsy Red that we saw with Oswald. Okay, now, interestingly enough, later on in the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, we see this interesting number here by an interesting connection here, rather, of Edgar Eugene Bradley to Jerry Owen. Okay, now keep in mind also the American United organization that was painting Ceylon red, because American United, Edgar Eugene Bradley, and Jerry Owen, and another right-wing evangelist named Bob Wells appear to have some connection. Certainly they move in the right circles, and there are some common addresses basically shared by all of them. In a footnote in the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, Turner and Christian write as follows. Foundation researcher Walter J. Carithers informed us in 1971 that American United, keep in mind that's Hilder and Steinbacher's organization, once used the address P.O. Box 285, Woodland Hills, California, on some of its Illuminati record albums. This is the same address on the letterhead of the Edgar Eugene Bradley Defense Fund, an ad hoc group of right-wing preachers raising money to defend him against the charges levied by D.A. Jim Garrison in the JFK assassination case. One of the signatories of a fundraising letter sent out in July of 1968 was Orange County evangelist Dr. Bob Wells. In his 1968 interview with Jerry Owen, Turner asked if the preacher knew Wells. Very well. He don't live far from me. Know him well. Unquote. Did Owen know of the Bradley-Wells tie-in? I think Bradley was to speak for him once. Unquote. So, Owen ties into Bradley. Bradley ties into Wells, Wells ties into Bradley, and Bradley ties into Edgar, the American United address. Keep in mind all of these connecting links, these evidentiary tributaries, and again, the attempt to paint Ceylon red.
Okay, going on and reading basically without prelude or prologue, a little bit more from the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. It says, at 7:15 on the evening after the RFK shooting, a compact man with goggle eyeglasses marched into LAPD headquarters with four companions. He gave his name as Major Jose Antonio Duarte and said he and his men were, quote, freedom fighters against Fidel Castro. A Cuban exile, Duarte reported that on May 21st he had attended a leftist meeting because he knew that support for Castro was on the agenda. When he rose to speak out, he said, a small, olive-skinned young man angrily accused him of being a CIA agent, and they got into a shoving match. The young man was Sirhan Sirhan. Duarte tried to unload his story on the news media, but it was ignored. Then, on June 11th, the Anaheim Bulletin headlined, quote, pro-Castro link to RFK slaying. The article, written by Duarte's political associate John Steinbacher of the same Hilder and Steinbacher America United, recounted the Cuban's putative encounter with Sirhan. Steinbacher arranged radio appearances for Duarte, and in an instant paperback book entitled Senator Robert Francis Kennedy, The Man, The Mysticism, The Murder, summed up, quote, Mayor Sam Yorty of Los Angeles has already brought out the pro-communist inclinations of Sirhan, but it was left to Major Jose Duarte, the Cuban anti-communist, to link Sirhan with the riots and unrest in our nation today. In time, the LAPD discredited Duarte's identification of Sirhan by producing a look-alike Iranian student who had been at the leftist meeting and recalled being involved in the altercation. However, the entire scenario struck us, meaning the authors, as all too familiar. In August 1963, Lee Harvey Oswald was accosted by an anti-Castro exile while handing out pro-Castro literature on the streets of New Orleans. Shortly after the scuffle, Oswald was invited to participate in a radio debate on the subject. And you heard that, by the way, on the first episode here of Guns of November. We played that actual radio interview, radio debate. In the evening of the day John Kennedy was shot, taped excerpts were broadcast nationally, and Oswald was heard by millions proclaiming, I am a Marxist. Both the debate and the assassination evening airing of the excerpts were arranged by Edward S. Butler, who headed a right-wing propaganda outfit in New Orleans called the Information Council of the Americas. Well, by 1968, Butler had moved to Los Angeles, where he carried on with financial aid from Patrick J. Frawley, Jr., chief executive officer of the Schick Safety Razor Company. For years, Frawley generously supported hardline conservatives such as Ronald Reagan, Barry Goldwater, and Sam Yorty. Frawley and Yorty belonged to the American Security Council, an embodiment of the military-industrial complex that lobbied for a bigger military establishment and ran a political blacklist service for its large corporation clients. Anthony Hilder also claimed to have the backing of Frawley, and Butler was present when Steinbacher and Hilder held their unattended press conference. Okay, that's the same Ed Butler who was involved with the interview that we played here on the air of Lee Harvey Oswald being led to proclaiming his Marxism on radio, and which was heard the night of the assassination. Ed Butler was also tied up and was at Hilder and Steinbacher's press conference. Continuing, the authors say, thus a right-wing clique colored the facts and conjured up visions of a sinister occult cabal to depict Sirhan as the pawn of an international plot. As the Anaheim Bulletin rhetorically asked in an editorial, quote, are foreign influences at work to conquer this country? Is a hidden plot progressing to eliminate the liberal leadership of the country and throw the movement completely into control of communist agents?
Now, the shooting of George Wallace, if you have any questions about it, ask us a little later, or stay tuned to the subsequent programming here on the station, because we'll talk about it at some length, okay? Again, this supposedly was the work of Arthur Bremer, a lone nut, no connections to anybody, and it removed George Wallace from the presidential campaign. Now, George Wallace, of course, was a right-winger himself, very much opposed to desegregation. That's how he made his political name. And he was going for the Democratic nomination in 1972. Now, he did not get the Democratic nomination and had no chance of doing so. He had announced his intention to run as a third-party candidate. Now, when he was shot and critically wounded by Arthur Bremer, what that basically did was to remove the possibility of him running as a third-party candidate. And in so doing, that guaranteed the, at least, operational sanctity of Richard Nixon's Southern strategy. And if Wallace, in other words, had followed through with his intent to run as a third party candidate, it might have jeopardized Nixon's his strategy to carry the country by carrying all of the South. Okay, when Sirhan shot George Wallace, that removed George Wallace as an independent party candidate. Okay, now keep in mind Jerry Owen, and keep in mind that supposedly there's again this just a bunch of lone nuts with no connection among each other. Now, as it turns out, Jerry Owen, remember, he's a right-wing TV evangelist. One of his followers is a woman named Gail Aiken, last name A-I-K-E-N. Now, Gail Aiken was Arthur Bremer's sister, and here we have him hooked up with Jerry Owen. Again, reading from the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. We discovered that Gail Aiken had known Owen for some time and undoubtedly accompanied him to the store. She had been a secretary to his college instructor brother since 1966 and was one of his most devoted religious followers. Immediately following the Wallace shooting, Owen somehow felt compelled to report his association with Aiken in an innocent context, just as he had with Sirhan, and again, he didn't go to the news media. However, instead of going to the police this time, he phoned newsman Baxter Ward's campaign headquarters. Ward was then running for his supervisorial post and excitedly insisted upon meeting the candidate. An appointment was set for the next day, but Owen failed to show up. Finally, Owen did show up at Ward's office. After first insisting to Ward that he hadn't called right after the Wallace shooting, he leaned forward sheepishly and in a low voice confided, "Do you realize that the girl who worked for my brother at Trade Tech College was the sister of the fellow who shot Wallace?" "No," Ward gasped. "And she just came to me and I helped her get an airplane ticket to go to Florida. They've been driving her crazy, poor little thing. She was my brother's secretary at Trade Tech for 8 years. The police and FBI had hounded her," Owen said, "and she came to him as a minister, unquote, for help. But he quickly revealed that there was more to it when he mentioned her promised return from her home in Miami to testify at his trial against KCOP and Orbox." "Unbelievable," Ward had commented when he informed Christian about Owen's disclosure. "Owen showing up in the background of the Wallace shooting is just too much to ask of coincidence." And apparently, as it turns out, Gail Aiken was going to be a key witness on behalf of Jerry Owen in his trial against KCOP, but was whisked out of town that same night. So again, a hard link between the Robert Kennedy assassination and the shooting of George Wallace.
Well, it was out of the Friday, September 16th, 1983, San Jose Mercury News. So this is a rather recent Mercury News. The article is headlined, "Birmingham Can't Wash Away 20-Year Stain of Black Girls' Deaths." It's by Olivia Barton, written for the Birmingham News, and it's about 20 years after the Birmingham bombings. And I'm just going to touch on some of the low points, in all reality, of the Birmingham bombings. The Birmingham bombings took place on September 15th, 1963, okay, so about 2 months before the death of John F. Kennedy. Killed in the Birmingham bombings were three 14-year-old girls, an 11-year-old girl named Denise McNair, and Carol Robertson, Cynthia Wesley, and Addie Mae Collins, all of them young black girls, all killed in the racially motivated bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church. Now, that Birmingham bombing was in a pre-Kennedy assassination America. It was one of the most shocking things that had happened to that point, and certainly one of the most shocking racial incidents of the time. Now, according to the article, skipping on down, the article is about Chris McNair, the father of one of the young girls killed, and he says, McNair says that the only conviction in the crime, that of former Ku Klux Klansman Robert Chambliss, Chambliss, in 1977, this is 14 years after the fact, for the murder of Denise, quote, wouldn't have happened except for the diligence of Bill Baxley, then state attorney general, now lieutenant governor, said McNair. Chambliss was charged with illegal possession of explosives 2 weeks after the blast. His conviction in city court was later overturned by a circuit court jury. But 14 years later, he was indicted and convicted of killing Denise. Now 79, Chambliss is serving a life sentence in state prison.
Okay, now that was one of the major incidents in the highly polarized struggle for civil rights in the South. Now, keep in mind the Birmingham bombing, because I'm about to read you some portions of a transcript of an interview between an undercover Miami police informant and a ultra-right-winger named Joseph Adams Miltier, last name M-I-L-T-E-E-R. Now, this interview here, again, between an undercover Miami police informant and Miltier, took place several weeks before the assassination of President Kennedy. And in this, the Miltier, the subject here, the two people are identified as informant and subject. Miltier not only described plans to kill President Kennedy killing him from assassination from a high-powered building, disassembling a rifle and taking it up there, which officially is what Oswald is supposed to have done, but he mentions that basically a patsy would have to be fingered to allow the real killers to escape, and not only described, which of course that's the official version of that is what actually happened. Of course, Lee Harvey Oswald became the patsy, the real killers escaped, and initially he describes some of the official version of the assassination of President Kennedy, killing Kennedy from ambush by disassembling a high-powered rifle, bringing it up to a skyscraper and shooting. And now this is interesting, because in this same transcript here, not only does Joseph Adams Miltier describe the official version of the assassination of President Kennedy plus what actually happened, he also talks about an impending attempt on the life of Martin Luther King, and he also links both crimes to the Birmingham bombing in 1963. Again, reading from the Assassinations, Dallas and Beyond, reading a small section here called, from an article called The Miltier Documents, and this in turn was from a book called Frame Up by author Harold Weisberg, a former FBI agent we've talked about before. I'm not going to read you the whole transcript here, but just a section of it. Again, the informant is an undercover Miami police informant, subject Joseph Adams Miltier. This, the information I'm about to read you was made available to the FBI on November 10th, 1963. Proceeding. Informant. I don't know. I think Kennedy is coming here on the 18th or something like that to make some kind of speech. I don't know what it is, but I imagine it will be on the TV, and you can be on the look for that. I think it is the 18th that he is supposed to be here. I don't know what it is supposed to be about. Subject. You can bet your bottom dollar he is going to have a lot to say about the Cubans. There are so many of them here. Informant. Yeah, well, he will have 1,000 bodyguards. Don't worry about that. Subject. The more bodyguards he has, the easier it is to get him. Informant. What? Subject. The more bodyguards he has, the more easier it is to get him. Informant. Well, how in the hell do you figure would be the best way to get him? Subject. From an office building with a high-powered rifle. How many people does he have going around who look just like him? Do you know that? Informant. No, I never heard that he had anybody. Subject. He has got them. Informant. He has? Subject. He has about 15. Whenever he goes anyplace, that they know he's a marked man. Informant. You think he knows he is a marked man? Subject. Sure he does. Informant. They are really going to try and kill him? Subject. Oh, yeah, it is in the working. Brown himself. Brown is just as likely to get him as anybody. He hasn't said so, but he tried to get Martin Luther King. Informant. He did? Subject. Oh, yes, he followed him for miles and miles and couldn't get close enough to him. Informant. You know exactly where it is in Atlanta, don't you? Subject. Martin Luther King? Yeah. Informant, Bustis Street. Subject, yeah, 530. Informant, oh, Brown tried to get him, huh? Subject, yeah. Informant, well, he will damn sure do it, I will tell you that. Well, that is why, look, you see, well, that is why we have to be so careful. You know that Brown is operating strong. Subject, he ain't going for play, you know. Informant, that is right. Subject, he is going for broke. Informant, I never asked Brown about his business or anything, you know, just what he told us, you know. But after the conversation and the way he talked to us, there is no question in my mind about who knocked off the church in Birmingham. You can believe that. That is the way I figured it. Subject. That is right. It is about the only way you can figure it. Informant. That is right. Subject. Not being there, not knowing anything. Informant. But just from his conversation, as you and me know him, but if they did it their business, like you say. Subject. It is up to the individual. Informant. That is right. They are individual operators. We don't want that within the party. Hitting this Kennedy is going to be a hard proposition. I tell you, I believe you may have figured out a way to get in. You may have figured out the office building and all that. I don't know how them Secret Service agent cover all them office buildings or anywhere he is going. Do you know whether they do that or not? Subject. Well, if they have any suspicion, they do that, of course. But without suspicion, chances are that they wouldn't. You take there in Washington, of course, it is the wrong time of the year, but you take pleasant weather. He comes out on the veranda, and somebody could be in a hotel room across the way there and pick him off just like... Informant, is that right? Subject, sure. Disassemble a gun. You don't have to take a gun up there. You can take it up in pieces. All those guns come knocked down. You can take them apart. Informant, they have got a... Damn, this boy was telling me yesterday about... They have got an explosive that you get out of the army. It is supposed to be like putty or something. You stick it up and use a small fuse. You just stick it like that, he told me, and I think that is what happened in the church in Birmingham. They stuck this stuff, somebody stuck it under the steps with a short fuse and went on home. Informant, this boy is pretty smart. Demolition, is that what you call it? Subject, demolition, that is right. Informant, I am going to talk with him some more. Subject, yeah, I would. Informant, I am going to talk with him some more and find out a lot more about his operation because he knows a hell of a lot. Subject, you need a guy like that around, too, where we can put our finger on him when we want him. Informant, yeah, well, you've got somebody up there in that country now if you need him. Subject, well, we're going to have to get nasty first. Informant, yeah, get nasty. Subject, we have got to be ready. We have got to be sitting on go, too. Informant, yeah, that is right. Subject, There ain't any countdown to it. We have just got to be sitting on go. Countdown, they can move in on you, and go, they can't. Countdown is all right for a slow, prepared operation. But in an emergency operation, you have got to be sitting on go. Informant, boy, if that Kennedy gets shot, we have got to know where we are at. Because, you know, that will be a real shake if they do that. Subject, They wouldn't leave any stone unturned there, no way. They will pick up somebody within hours afterwards if anything like that would happen, just to throw the public off, inform it. Oh, somebody's going to have to go to jail if he gets killed. So again, there you have it. Plans to assassinate King, Kennedy, and linked with the Birmingham church bombing. All of this information made available to FBI in 11-10-63.
That's right. 13 days, 12 days before the John F. Kennedy assassination. Okay, again, a couple of more things we want to talk about specifically the Martin Luther King assassination. Quite a bit of the information we're using here comes out of a book called Government by Gunplay. It's another anthology book. It's subtitled Assassination Conspiracy Theories from Dallas to Today, edited by Sid Blumenthal and Harvey Yazigian of the Assassination Information Bureau. We've used some sources out of this on the broadcast before, and this is copyright 1976 by Sid Blumenthal and Harvey Yazigian, and Signet Books is who published this paperback edition. Now, brief thing, just touching on, again, we don't have much time to talk about all the inadequacies in the government's case against James Earl Ray. Those of you who are familiar with the case will remember some of them.
One thing, before getting down to the material about James Earl Ray and that assassination, one detail I'd like to throw in at this time. Again, from this same essay, The Assassination of Martin Luther King by Jeff Cohen, concerns the fact, now, recall the Birmingham church bombing and the links from that conversation with the Kennedy and King assassinations. Now, the very first, the mayor of Birmingham, rather, at the time that the Birmingham church was bombed, was a fellow named Arthur Haynes. His last name is H-A-N-E-S. Now, Arthur Haynes was a former CIA contract employee. He was also a lawyer, and when James Earl Ray was fingered as the lone assassin of Martin Luther King, his first attorney was Arthur Haynes, mayor of Birmingham during the bombing and a former CIA contract employee.
That's right. What a wacky coincidence, huh?
Again, another link between these events.
Just another crazy coincidence. Okay, reading again from Jeff Cohen's article, The Assassination of Martin Luther King, which is in the book Government by Gunplay. It goes as follows. One of the shoddiest aspects of the police/FBI investigation was the selection of Charles Q. Stevens as the state's star witness. On the night of the slaying, Stevens, a roomer, meaning he lived in a rooming house, told Memphis reporter Wayne Chastain, quote, "I saw who done it. It was a nigger. I saw him run out of the bathroom. I will never testify against the man who killed Martin Luther Coon, even if it were a nigger who done it." Bessie Brewer overheard Stevens' statement and told the reporter Chastain to disregard it. Quote, "He was so drunk he didn't see or hear anything." Lloyd Jowers, the manager of Jim's Cafe, located below the rooming house, testified that Stevens was inebriated that afternoon. Cab driver James McGraw testified at the 1974 hearing that Stevens was drunk at 5:45 p.m., 15 minutes before King was killed. Stevens, who had phoned for a cab, quote, "was lying on the bed and couldn't get up. He was falling down drunk." Private Stone, a fireman, stated that Stevens visited the nearby station, quote, "every night at 6 p.m. intoxicated." According to press photographer Ernest Withers, the day after the murder, Stevens didn't recall that someone had been shot. Stevens' original statement to the police was that he saw nothing, that he was in the kitchen where he could not see what happened. Accordingly, he was ignored by the police and FBI. But 6 weeks later, Stevens declared that his memory was reawakened after Ray's picture appeared on the front pages. The man he saw was not only Lily White, he said, but was James Earl Ray. Stevens claimed he heard the shot fired from the bathroom and saw Ray run out with a rifle. Stevens became the only eyewitness who would link the accused assassin to the murder scene. If Ray's... Let me just go back and read that sentence one more time. Stevens became the only eyewitness who would link the accused assassination to the murder scene. If Ray's London attorney had known of Stevens' original police statement, the, quote, "nigger story," his drunken condition, or his police record containing 155 arrests, it is likely that Ray would not have been extradited. During the extradition hearings, the FBI took Stevens into protective custody at posh motels, gave him money, openly paid his drinking bills at Jim's Cafe, and hid him from the press. It cost the taxpayers $31,000 to hold the state's star witness, according to Memphis Police Chief. On the day the FBI whisked Stevens into protective custody, his common-law wife, Grace Walden, was mysteriously committed to a mental institution by someone in the Memphis City government. 3 years later, a judge ruled that her commitment was illegal and unorthodox. Grace Walden's attorney charged that the FBI, county prosecutor, and Memphis police had conspired to commit her in order to destroy her credibility as a witness who would contest Stevens' quote, observations. Quote, they had to get rid of me to make Charlie's story stand up in court, Ms. Walden told her attorney. She said that Charlie was intoxicated and had almost passed out in the kitchen. Unlike Stevens, Grace Walden's story has never varied. On the night of the murder, she told Chastain that she clearly saw a white man without a rifle leave the bathroom soon after the shot was fired. It sounded like the shot came from outside her window, not from the bathroom, she said. The man apparently entered another room down the hall. She heard two doors slam. Ms. Walden described the man as short, only 5'6", small physique, quote, salt and pepper hair, in his 50s and wearing a military field jacket. The small man apparently grabbed the bundle containing Ray's rifle and belongings from the other room, ran down the stairs, and dropped the load implicating Ray. Let me just one more time give you this man's physique, that Grace Walden, who is committed apparently to prevent her from contradicting Charles Stevens' story, she described the man that she saw without a gun but coming out of the room as being 5'6", small physique, salt and pepper hair, in his 50s, wearing a military field jacket.
Okay, now, about the actual shooting of Martin Luther King. Now, pay close attention to the physical circumstances here. Try and visualize, if you can, the actual physical location of these various elements. King was shot from ambush and appeared to be lifted up. He was standing on a second-floor balcony overlooking a motel and appeared to have been lifted up by the shot, okay? Now, again, pay close attention to the physical circumstances of the crime here, because it's going to help your understanding of the speech we're going to play in a minute. Again, from the assassination of Martin Luther King by Jeff Cohen in Government by Gunplay. Where was the gunman? Several eyewitnesses contend the gunman fired from the rooming house backyard where bushes atop an embankment faced King's motel across the street. Yes, a grassy knoll. At the instant he was shot, Martin Luther King was leaning over a second-floor motel balcony talking to his chauffeur, Solomon Jones, who was on the ground floor. Jones said that King seemed to be lifted off the balcony by the bullet. This upward trajectory suggests a lower assassin's perch, more consistent with the bushes than the second-floor window. I heard the shot and turned around and saw a man with a white sheet on his face and some bushes over there, Jones recounted. When the gunman hunkered down again, unquote, as if he were going to fire another shot, Jones took cover. When the chauffeur looked up seconds later, he thought he saw the same man, without white sheet and rifle, walk out of the bushes and casually join firemen running toward the motel. Rumor Harold Cornbread Carter told police that he happened to be drinking wine in the bushes at 6 p.m. when he heard a shot ring loudly in his ear. Cornbread looked around and saw a man flee by him so close, quote, he kicked gravel on me, unquote. An 11-year-old black youth saw a white man jump down from the bushes onto the street soon after the shot. The 11-year-old ran 100 yards to the nearby fire station, told what he saw to three firemen, and was whisked to police headquarters. Two police detectives who were surveilling King from a concealed position in the firehouse watched him get struck. They believe the shot came from the nearby bushes, not from the window 20 feet above. Bertie Reeves and Willie Auschultz, two ear witnesses, unquote, located inside the rooming house, said the shot came from the bushes, unquote. Again, not from the second floor window Ray supposedly fired from. Now, next, Cohen describes some of the ballistics evidence and cites a former FBI ballistics expert named McDonald. Ballistics expert Herbert McDonald, M-A-C-D-O-N-E-L-L, testified at Ray's 1974 hearing that there was, quote, no way, unquote, the rifle said to have killed King could have been fired from the rooming house bathroom window. After examining a dented windowsill on which the state maintains Ray rested his rifle, McDonald declared that, quote, to get the proper angle, the rifle would have stuck 6 inches into the wall, unquote. The state contends that Ray twisted himself into a contorted firing position, straddling the rim of the bathtub. Ray's attorney, Bernard Fensterwald, remarked, quote, it's inconceivable to me that no one from the defense would have examined the room to see if a shot was possible from that window. There's no proof that the bullet was fired from that window, and there's lots of evidence to show that it was from somewhere else, unquote. Dr. J.T. Francisco, who was originally assigned by the court to determine the circumstances and cause of death, testified, quote, from my findings, I could not exclude other sites in the bathroom window as the source of the bullet, unquote. Ballistics expert McDonald also contested the FBI ballistics report, which stated, quote, due to mutilation, No conclusion could be drawn that the submitted bullet from King's body came from the submitted rifle bought by Ray. McDonnell argued that an identification could have been possible if the rifle had been test-fired to examine the slug. So the FBI never even test-fired the rifle Ray supposedly used to kill King.
All right. And summing up the material we're going to present on Martin Luther King tonight, at least as far as the material on the record, the cold gray print, here's another section out of Government by Gunplay. Again, Jeff Cohen's article, The Assassination of Martin Luther King. And it says as follows, 90 minutes before King was slain, an hour and a half before Martin Luther King died, a dark, athletically built man entered Jim's Cafe, that's the cafe just below the rooming house in question, and ordered eggs and sausage, no liquor. Manager Lloyd Jowers and the waitress say they will never forget this well-dressed, sober man who fit about as well in the Skid Row Cafe as Nelson Rockefeller at a Poor People's March. The man appeared irritated as he walked to the phone twice, but did not make a call. An hour after he paid his bill and left, Jowers heard an exploding sound in the back of his cafe. Jowers and the waitress conjecture that the eggs and sausage man, not Ray, killed King. When asked about suspicious persons, Jowers mentioned the eggs and sausage man to police and was told to call them if he ever showed up again. Jowers was startled the following morning when the suspicious stranger returned. A different waitress took his order, eggs and sausages. Jowers called the cops. They picked him up after breakfast. The man was apparently held by Memphis police for the FBI, who quickly released him. That night, a police captain told Jowers, "That eggs and sausage guy you put us on must have had some real connections. One phone call and he was gone. He wasn't in the station more than an hour." 5 days later, Memphis attorney Russell X. Thompson was visited by a mystery man who introduced himself as Tony Benavides and then admitted it's an alias. According to Thompson, quote, Benavides claimed to know how the King assassination actually occurred, not the way it was reported in the press. Skipping on down, talking about, now they're mentioning that Dwayne Chastain, who is a reporter who is working on the investigation of the Martin Luther King murder. Through photographs shown to them by reporter Chastain and attorney Thompson, Jowers and the waitress have identified the eggs and sausage man and Benavides, Tony Benavides, the alias just mentioned, as being one and the same person, Jack Youngblood. Youngblood, according to Chastain, is a marksman and soldier of fortune who has worked with the CIA against Cuba and had a book ghostwritten about his exploits during Batista's last months. A high-ranking Memphis police official told Chastain that the Eggs and Sausage Man was an FBI informant and an Army intelligence agent. Now, there's a little more of this section talking about things that Youngblood told the attorney about how the King killing was put together in terms of an advance man coming in to representing himself as part of the King campaign and claiming to be a part of the King campaign and making sure that King had an upper floor balcony room and there was no such person attached to the King campaign, etc., that we don't really have time to go into now.
Well, it's one thing that is worth mentioning is that initially at the Lorraine Motel, they were going to assign him, I've never seen any record of what room they were going to assign him, but supposedly an advance man came in and had the following information. He said, basically, no, Mrs. Bailey, that simply won't do. Dr. King always likes to stay on the second floor overlooking a swimming pool. The thing that's interesting about that is that speculation was made by an employee of the hotel that this was a white man posing in blackface. In other words, had put on makeup to make him appear black, and that this was the fellow who had arranged for Dr. King to stay on the second floor motel. Now, the thing that's worth noting is that Dr. King never used advance men, and so as he got word of this advance man arranging for him to stay over the second stay on the second floor room overlooking the pool, he must have known certainly that the advance man was not his advance man.
Indeed. And while you're thinking about the frame of mind that Martin Luther King might have been in and how he might have looked at these kinds of things and the hatred that he knew was held for him not only by the police and the FBI but various other elements in the American governmental system, let me talk about one other thing real quickly, and then we are going to, this will wrap up the information section of the show. Just briefly, we've been talking about Martin Luther King and Robert F. Kennedy, and one of the sources we used a lot is a book called Government by Gunplay. We use that mostly for Martin Luther King. Well, there is a section in Government by Gunplay, an article written entitled Who Killed Robert Kennedy, which again covers some of the terse physical evidence leading to real doubt of the Sirhan as the lone nut theory, including the L.A. Police Department destroying evidence and things about the problem with logistics, the flat refutation the coroner's report makes of special unit senators' verdict, et cetera, et cetera. Well, Who Killed Robert Kennedy is written by a man named Allard K. Lowenstein, who is a former government official himself and an intimate of Robert Kennedy, things of that nature. And I'm going to read you the last paragraph and then tell you something about Allard Lowenstein.